before diagnosis. The lake is dead for a second time this January. And no matter how many geese lay their warm breast against the ice or fly across its hard chest, it doesn't break or sink or open up and swallow them. The ice is frozen water. There is no metaphor for exile. Even if these trees continue to shake the crows from their branches, my sister is still farther away from her mind than we are from each other, sitting on opposite ends of a park bench, waiting for the evening to swallow us whole. In the last moments of a depressive, a son. In the last moments of a son, my sister says a man is chasing a goose through the snow. Thank you, VCU. Thank you, Greg Donovan, Greg Kimbrell, Kathy, everybody for having me out here. Rachel, Christian, I've corresponded with so many folks. This is amazing. Like, as a young poet, all the young poets in the room know, we just writing in our notebooks. Even the old poets know this. We're just writing in our notebooks all the time. All we're doing is just writing in the notebook. And we hope that poems land one day and that we get careful readers and thoughtful readers. So thank you. So I feel like we're family. So because we're family, normally I don't show people my runner's feet, but you know, we're gonna do runner's feet today. And what I mean by that is I'm just gonna relax and I'm gonna read for y'all. And we're gonna just have a good time. Me and Catherine's from the same area. This is like Jersey love right here. I got family in Virginia. Let's do it. This next poem is for Emmett Till. And most of us probably know who Emmett Till is, but just in case we don't. Emmett Till was a young black man who traveled to the South from Chicago in the 1950s. As the story goes, he either looked at a white woman, whistled at a white woman, said, hey, baby, to a white woman, winked at a white woman. He did something, maybe nothing, maybe he just was black. And the family of this white woman, of course, this is Mississippi, it's Money, Mississippi, were incredibly upset. And that's a mild way of saying it, and decided to lynch him. There was a story my mother used to tell me with the Bible. I grew up with like, and God said, let there be light, and Emmett Till. This poem was haunting me for a long, long time. And it was one of the first poems that I felt like, yes. It took me a lot of drafts in 5 years to get to. So this is The Mayor of Money, and it's for Emmett Till. Another dead mayor waits in the shoals of some body of water. Waits to be burdened. Born into a foaming ocean where it might become food for whales or simply empty signifier. Hair latched to the sea's undulation like Absalom's beauty. Caught in the branches of a tree desiring union. Entanglement. Thick confusion. But not this mayor. She does not get the luxury of a lyric, a song that makes our own undoing or killing sweet, even as we go down into the fire to rise as smoke. This horse must lie, eyes open among the stone and freshwater crawfish in Money, Mississippi. She listens to the men's boots break the water when they drop a black boy's body near her head, then pick him up, only to let him fall again, there, bent and eye to eye with her, as though decaying is something that requires a witness. As though the mayor might say, on Tuesday after the rain fell, the boy's neck finally snapped from the weight of the mill fan. He never looked at me again. Or the boy might say, no more. They part here, the boy's body carried back to town by another, as the horse stays, says nothing, because horses don't speak. Besides, this one's dead. So let's stay in the South a bit. This next poem, I used to live in Austin, Texas, and I always like to give a little preamble to this poem because it can be shocking at times for people. But I was running in front of campus, and a guy decided to follow me. Happens, people follow you while you run, I guess. And he decided to shout nigger at me as I ran for probably about a half mile. And so a friend of mine had challenged me to write a poem about running many years ago, and I wasn't able to do it. And I was like, oh, I think I can do it now. So this is the poem that came about. Cross country. When I ran, it rained niggers. Early in October, the first creases of autumn, a flag-weary sky in which yellow birds in flight slip through the breastbone of God and tear at the coarse threads that keep the morning knit tightly around his heart. What was it that they sang about the light? Their tongues, the thistles they pluck from the bitter bark of an allthorn, then thrust into the breast of whatever god or good animal requires eating, a good piercing. These blonde bodies thrashing about above me were death's idea of the morning passing. Here, below this golden altar, the making and unmaking of my body, the kettle clank and souring sumac of a man yelling at the light, slipping in and out of my mouth. What name must I carry above the dust of this field? Bruised ear, blank body, purple tongue, bloody God bleeding, do you hear me? Deer piss in poison ivy made pungent by the dew and morning sun rising, do you hear me? When I ran, it rained niggers. In a ditch along the road, a pair of wild boars slain and laid tusks to tail point as if required in two directions at once. Toward my body, pressing the last bits of a hunter's moon into the tar of this road and away from the metal red light coming up through the chaff, rising above this hectored field and the man yelling, nigger in the cicadas tuning up to tear the morning into tatters, nigger in the squawk and clatter of a hen complaining of a hand reaching below her bottom and removing the warm work of a cold night, nigger in the reeds covering the muck of a beaver's hard birth, nigger in the blue hour of a field once wet with the breath of a lone horse cracking along its flanks, nigger in the fog lifting from this field and the steel berth it reveals, nigger in the running, in the bog at the end of this road, in the war and in between the wars, nigger in the pink salt and eyelashes of a woman I love, her mouth pulling water from behind my knee, pulling, 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 think nigger is the god of our brief salvation, nigger in a body falling toward a horizon, nigger in a twilight that is no longer a twilight, but a black creek fumbling along the spine of a boy who is running through a city that is running out of water. Even the lions have left for the mountains. This is America speaking in translation, in glitter, in gold grills and fried chicken. Auto-tune this if you must. Cher will be singing in the brush of static from the attic radio, believing in love after love, life after love, or love after love, despite the impure thoughts of evening, despite the rain soaking the red head of a red bird, now dead in a puddle that refuses to reflect the moon. So next, let's go to Britain. I feel like we're gonna travel around the world a little bit. So this really happened. In a brief animated world, the marriage of Anne of Denmark to James of Scotland, 1589. Nature always begins with resistance. The small congregation of ants refusing to allow the femur bone of the fox to rest meatless, the heavy head of flies in January straying from the graves, which are the corners of this house, the four Negroes at Queen Anne's wedding dancing in the snow, naked before her carriage, the creak of carriage wheels counting out steps, one, two, three, turn, jump, turn, their arms wide as goose wings, bow, then a breaking at the waist. Mucus spills from their mouths on two, and before a guest from Oslo can point to the blood-tinged saliva, the wagon wheels gather every stitch of spit, grind, then smear. The body, if allowed, will dance, even as it is ruined. A mule collapsing in a furrow, it's just hewed. The sway and undulation of the famished. There are no straight lines but unto death. Four men turning circles in the snow. The arch of their toes calling Anne to lean forward. Admire the work of the unshod sinking below all this white. She thinks, in a brief animated world, this would not be agony. The leg of her fox stole slips from her shoulders and points to the men shivering in their last plié. Yes, she thinks, but agony is sometimes necessary. So this next poem, Catherine talked about a bit in the introduction, which is Self-Portrait is Ernestine Tiny Davis. And I became fascinated with Ernestine Tiny Davis, and finding as much archival stuff I could find on her YouTube was actually quite helpful. She was a great trumpeter. She was a contemporary of Louis Armstrong and Clark Terry. Louis Armstrong, in fact, tried to buy her. Not literally buy her like a slave, but tried to buy her away from the Sweethearts of Rhythm because he felt like she was such a great trumpeter. But she refused because she had this group already. And she eventually retires from the Sweethearts of Rhythm, International Sweethearts of Rhythm, and opens, I believe, the first gay club in Chicago called Ruby and Dee's Gay Place. And Dee was her partner. And there's some documentary footage of her talking about being an out lesbian in the 40s and 50s and starting this club in Chicago. She's one of my heroes, sheroes. So I felt like I had to write this poem that was kind of cyborgish. So this is Self-Portrait as Ernestine Tiny Davis. Call me Hippo. Call the woman beneath me a broken boat, a thin white skiff, a toothpick unhinging a speck of pepper from between my gapped teeth. Call the curtains close. Call that tour bus to cover my breast. Once a man scraped me jagged as a pine cone. I scraped him white as a star, then left him and his head in a trough beside a pen of pigs. Call the trough home. Call daddy out of this wet house. I can't sing without hearing a man slipping below water, clean as butter, clean as a roach sliding down the thin throat of a crow. Call the road from Chicago to Memphis, brief encounters with an axe and a woman who carries dust in her mouth. Call Jesus down from that cross. Call my tongue a crown of thorns, a patch of nettles sunk deep in an arm. I've found every sparrow God has forgotten to watch over. I've wreathed them in briars and hung them from the back fence. They say they're tired of singing. They sang only to be noticed. I am noticing. They are noticed. Funny little beast, often mistaken for something that should be pierced. A spine broken on a thorn, then eaten, breast first. Call me tiny, anything small. An acorn lodged in the throat of a thrush, choke. A claw squeezed from the purple head of a flower, prick. A hunk of pork butt plucked from the gums and placed back onto the tongue, gag, then swallow. Feed me, call my appetite a kind kingdom. Call me queen, king me. So I like this postmodern poetry collective called Wu-Tang Clan. And I was for a long time trying to figure out why I liked them so much. And I think part of it is the referentiality. I think the way in which they deploy allusions really reminds me of Shakespeare in the sense that they believe in innovating allusions. So they'll take something that we know and sort of inhabit it in this different way. Modernists like Pound is always like, make it new, and we're running around still saying it. Make it new. They didn't say that. That's not what folks were saying for most of the world. But I just love Wu-Tang. And so, yeah, I'm gonna read some Wu-Tang poems to y'all. Y'all all right with that? All right, let's do it. Shadowboxing Herons for Wu-Tang Clan in 1992. Also, I should note, so Wu-Tang Clan got introduced to me on a basketball court, and that might be significant because I always think about them in the rhythm of the ball, and I always think about them in concert with other men. I feel like it's a very homosocial space, right? But we don't talk about hip-hop and, like, homosociality. We too hard for that. Shadowboxing Herons for Wu-Tang Clan in 1992. Shaolin's flowers, imperial and ready for slaughter. Bobby Digital wears the wings of the only saint he knows. Come, blessed angel, with your skull cup of blood. Enter this chamber with your black sword and a streetcar full of flagging desire. When the children ask for water, give them wind without a box to put it in. When they ask why wind, tell them the banks require deposits to own anything with and without blood. Cash rules the bullet as well as the ode to the animal that eats his own heart. Who has not come to this world with a skylight in their chest and a forest of Japanese pines growing below? Who would not bless the herons bowing before us? How many men have you convinced to sing naked in the snow? Another poem was another Wu-Tang poem, but I always feel like Wu-Tang always invites me to think about the haiku. This is me thinking about the haiku in the long form. This is called In the Lone Horse and Plum, Wu-Tang. Basho, master of snow and ghost, and the frog leaping into the summer's golden hall of light, and the iris leaves tied to your sandals and lashing the evil spirits licking at your shadow, and the rice planting songs in the hunchback of a horse carrying a general's body to the snowy eaves of his house, and the armored hymn of the cricket and scorpion, and the soldiers praying in the bush clover, their swords mottled in white, and the cathedral in the first broken melon of summer on the sidewalk, and the moon in the one house it makes for the tea kettle, widow and clattering dead, and the crane feathers thrown into the fire, and the lone persimmon tree in this field of cotton, and the sparrow's smile smeared across our morning windows, and the white gourds rattling in our heads, and the carpenter hanging his own shelves, and the priest's umbrella, and the pestilence of shuddering in the corner of the shed, and the rags tied in our lover's hair, and our dilapidated sleep. I hear the shimmy shimmy of men dismantling the day with hammers and the semiotics of axes. Even when the metal red light of evening comes sluicing through the pines and pagodas, it comes through raw, swinging sledgehammers trying to crack the skull of the crow sleeping inside our porcelain lives. I am ashamed that I have not mentioned their names, or the cranes balancing on the edges of railings, looking into stairwells and smelling of piss and loose risk. Basho, I am the willing minstrel with honey on his tongue, smearing the burnt cork of anybody's ode onto his face. I recover from the end of the year only what can be sold to the next. Copper, bone, coffins, what the blackbirds are unwilling to bury their dead in. I don't know if you poets have this. Poets tend to have this probably. You first read a poet and you're like, man, I really hate everything this poet is writing. And then you kind of constantly stay with that poet for a while and the years pass and then eventually you're like, that's the greatest poet in the world. And that sort of happened with me, I'll admit this, with Yeats. When I first encountered Yeats, I was like, this is the worst. Not the gyre stuff, but the political poem. You're just like, got it. Like 1930, you're like, I don't. But then you sort of start to find your way in a poet. And so I started finding my way in Yeats. And there was this one poem that I found particularly moving, and he had this line of when I come to the valley of the black pig, and I sort of started playing with that line a bit. When I come to the valley of the black pig, the stars threshed, the soul spinning beneath the ready guillotine of morning. I come not as the hog before slop and trough, but as the dizzy trembling of day on the back of a hand, already an hour into a labor that outlasts the falling of empires. I come bearing visions of a boy pulling coal from fire, wearing the dress and girdle of lovers who refuse to dress. The hand already singed and palsied from this work. I labor alongside earthquakes and yellow parakeets, sweating in the loom and loam of a July heat, twittering in complete obedience to your mechanical will. Dear God, I've been your crooked plow and song. The horseman and his sudden death, the frame of the door aflame, the burning house built to heal the sick. Dear God, what do I do with a body battered on behalf of you? When I moved to Austin, Texas, I was raised in Jersey and then I moved to Texas. And at first I was hanging out with a lot of hippies. I love hippies, that's my joint. I think like Free Love, Strawberry Farms, it's my joint. And then I moved to Austin and I found out about hipsters. And I hadn't heard of a hipster before, other than Amiri Baraka talking about him. But I was like, clearly, these aren't the same hipsters. But I got kind of fascinated with the aesthetic of hipsterism. And I thought, what would a black hipster race poem be like? So it made me think about Basquiat, because he probably would have been a black hipster in the 80s. And then I started thinking about my hipster poem would be, and so this is it. Some Young Kings. The Mike Tyson in me sings like a narwhal, minus the nasally twang of sleeping in a cold ocean. The unsightly barnacles latch to the mattress of skin just below my eye. The unsightly barnacles latch to the top of my head. Oh God bless us mutts, the basset bloodhound mulattoes, the pug mixed puppies, as German shepherds, Labradoodles and Portuguese water dogs turn their inbred behinds and narrow backs at our small mouth blues. It's hard to smile with an ear in your mouth, two names and a daughter hanging by a thread from the railing of a treadmill. Old neck and North Carolina and a white coat of paint for all the faces of my Negro friends hanging from trees in Salisbury, Greensboro, and Guilford County. The hummingbirds inside my chest with their needle-nose pliers for tongues and hammer-heavy wings have left a mess of tinks in my lungs and a punctured lullaby in my throat. Little boy blue can blow your horn, the cows in the meadow, and Dorothy's alone in the corn with Jack, his black fingers, the brass of his lips, the half-moons of his fingernails clicking along her legs until she howls, Charlie Parker, Charlie Parker, Charlie Parker. Oz is a man with a mute body on an HBO original show that I am too afraid to watch for fear of finding my uncle or a man that looks like my uncle, which means finding a man that looks like me and another man's embrace or slumped over a shiv made from a mattress coil and a bar of ivory soap. Most young kings return home without their heads. It's 1941, and Jack Johnson still loves white women, and my mother won't forgive him. If she can't use your comb, don't bring her home, my mother says in 1998. It's 2009, and I still love white women. Charlie Parker, Charlie Parker, Charlie Parker. Often I click the heels of my Nikes together when talking to the police. I am a cricket crushed beneath a car's balding black tires. Most young kings return home without their heads. This next poem is for Jermaine Jimenez, a brother. Maggot therapy. Not the debridement of the wound. The wedding dress decanted of the bones and snow-blown skin of a bride circling through the splinters of winter. The ash and orchard of a gray heaven surrounding the tumble of guests leaking out into the night to wish her sloughing off of dress and wound well. No. Not this debridement, which is greeted with cake and symbol and the calling on of a mastering god, which is perhaps the dusk erasing itself from day, the healthy skin of night pulled taut over the bone clots of stars, the chronic fever of noon driven off like the fox to the farthest blue hills, the fever kept there, hidden, hot, and vigilant in the fox's mouth, which is perhaps the debridement I have been looking for. Something that will linger inside a suicide and eat around the bullet still thrumming against the salt and clatter of a brother's brain that is now below the bob and tether of an ocean that opens itself like a wound. Maggot, how lightly you travel through the ribs of beggars and barns, kings and convents. How often they've misnamed your benevolence. Teach me again that I do not own this body that walks me over this snow and cracked pavement, the winter light pulling at my bare ankles. Teach me what to do with the dead I carry in my mouth. Teach me to travel light with their bodies in my belly. I'm kind of fascinated with very obscure things like parasites, but all poets are. We all have obsessions. That's what helps to teach us about form in a lot of ways. And so there's this parasite that I found out that was discovered in 2005. And it was discovered in a fish market in Britain, though the fish was shipped from California. And there was a parasite found in the fish's mouth. What this parasite is named is Somathoa exiguia. And what the parasite does is it eats the tongue off of the fish, spotted red snappers, and then it replaces the tongue with its body. And so when the fish eats, the parasite eats. However, scientists have found out that this does not inhibit the life of the fish, nor it doesn't shorten the life of the fish. So there's this sort of really interesting relationship between this parasite and the fish. As I was reading different texts on parasites, like Parasite Rex and different texts on parasites, I started thinking about parasitism, putting it in conversation with lynching. Partly because lynching culture had an aesthetic. It wasn't just like, oh, we just killed the person and kind of left them there. It was the carnivalesque. If we know anything about killing and the carnivalesque and ritual, there's an aesthetic to it. And what often happened in lynchings is that they would cut the tongue and fingers off the lynch person. And often they would remake the lynch person, remake their body. So they might stuff a pipe into their mouth. You'll see that in the poem. Or they might, as I said, in Some Young Kings, there's a white coat of paint for all the faces of my Negro friends. Because literally, they would paint the faces with white at times. So there's this whole aesthetic to lynching. So I started thinking about this sort of parasitism, lynching, and what is made, how does one feed off of the other? And so this next poem is called Samathwa Exeguia. The tongue as what it is not, blemish and parasite, gimp and glottal stop. What question can be answered with a truant mouth? Can the lynched man hung from the sails of a windmill taste the lead pipe wedged between his lips? When the signifiers dangle, empty chum lines in a cold creek. When the men in Waco wearing white straw hats, fraying at the crisp edges of their white shirts, leave Jesse, leave John, leave Paul in ashes in the unpaved streets to choke the passing mules into prophecy. When we pinch our noses to staunch the smell of the twice-burned black man burning for a third time this day. When the boys, sweet and good animals, come to what's been left in shallow ditches, false rib and femur, clavicle and severed hand, quite simply the language of sorrow, glyph of the gadfly rooting himself into the rotting meat of the dead. When it is too late to refuse our bodies being made urns, corn, unharvested and heavy in its husk. When in the marketplace the butcher lifts our tongue from a bed of ice, shouts, who will speak for this flesh? When the tongue answers as all severed tongues do. I'm a big fan of Rilke, sort of. I am a big fan of Rilke. I think it's always great to be able to battle rap some of the best poets in history. And so one of the things I'm really interested in is thinking about aesthetics. Like, Rilke probably would have popped a lot of shit. He would have been a battle rapper. He would have been so good at hip hop. He would have been ready. Him and Jay-Z would have probably had like the Rock together or something. But one of the things that I always think about is I write these battle poems. Can I write a poem that's talking smack back? And so this one is Brief Angel. Most people wouldn't know that it's a battle rap poem. I always like to explain that. Even Rilke bows to this lone black tree I have made in a South German forest. The sun's washed corpse leaking. The snow, a tired mouth, opening beneath my feet, which says nothing of the owls falling heavy from heaven onto the necks of rodents. I've fed you with this type of vision before. A white sheet, dead and flat as a god, descending from heaven and bearing all manner of wild beast, four-footed and fettered, fish, fowl, eat, nothing I sent before you is unclean. Behold, I am him who you seek. Slender black tree in a South German forest. Tired mouth, white sheet, washed corpse. When was the last time you called the living to rise, walking them out of the orchard fires, past a lion who walks the walls of this city, lost in the snow and kerfluffle of your grief? What anger lurking in a piece of silk have you ignored? I have sent what terror I could, the head of a white tiger with a mouth full of black figs, a police captain whistling about a three-legged foal falling from heaven, and yes, a foal falling into a zero on a bed of straw and dung. Behold, I am him who you seek. Brief angel, black fig, orchard fire, white tiger, lost lion, a song of coming destruction. Nothing I have brought before you is unclean. I am him who you seek. Eat, even this palm stretched out before you, meat. When has a god ever brought bread that hasn't required a bit of breaking, a fig crushed, a body made to sing, even as it is shattered? Just a few more poems, y'all. I know, poetry readings, boy. I wish we could do like a live Twitter feed, or you could see a Twitter feed over my head, like a halo of Twitter feed. No, I'm just playing. Actually, I wouldn't like that. I wouldn't like that at all. It's a lie. This next poem is called Thinking of Anne Frank in the Middle of Winter. There's a boy whose face I've touched once, like these blackbirds peck and lick at frozen cat food sitting outside my door, and pie tins that clatter against anything that will touch them. Eventually, they will drag their tinny bottoms across the driveway cement until they rest against a spigot's dry mouth, as if to say, whatever the price, I'll pay. A bruise, a sheaf of paper, an attic. Peter, where is the checkered suit you snagged against a stray nail when we lay together straighter than the attic boards that warped beneath us? How did we know this was not enough? A boot, a creak, a cloud of dust rising from a blanket that covered our shattering cheeks. Your lips moving against the back of my neck, even as I pulled away. Peter, I too love anything that reaches and fails. So this is the love portion of the night. You know, I'm an elegiac writer, and so people are like, why you write so sad poems? I'm like, they're not sad, they're happy. It's like the blues. You sing about sad situation, but in the singing is the happiness. That's what people don't get about the blues, right? The singing is the testament to the life. So if you sing and you alive, it's pretty awesome. So this is my version of like love that you'll hear, which is, you're alive, yay. Next poem is called Romanticism, the Blue Keats. I want a terrace of bamboo, a stuttering harp, a garden fitted with a grotto and gimp hermit. I want to lose my last name in the crickets coupling beneath my feet. I want the body's burden, four more angels to drag through the streets of a city that finds the monkey sacred, the fool careful, the monk dumb. I want a painting of persimmons and a persimmon. I want the violence of my love to leave my sleep and my lover alone. I am dedicated to the same baffled heart I have always carried, the diamonds in mud of my mouth, the midsummer lurching toward the late summer heat that will kill the sage and tomato plants tanning on the veranda. I want the water and the leg my uncle lost coming from the well. If one body will hide another and call this hiding love, I want to always torture myself with another's wet borders, an ankle clicking against an ankle, the wrist fettered. There was something I knew before this, before my hands tore at the ropes, snapped cedar poles, and ripped the silk of any tent I lay in. I want to know how the savage wind loves the house it destroys. I want to know before I am both house and savage wind, before all of the tents in the city become tattered rags snagged in the hair of our children and the red-headed trees. I am careful to want nothing that I cannot lose and be sad in the losing. A terrace made of rotting bamboo, a harp lost in its singing. My last name and the tomatoes falling from the vine. Woman, I want this plum heart and the dying that makes us possible. And for the last poem I'll read tonight, because we have to get on. In our lives, we can't stay in poetry world forever. It's a poem that I kind of wrote to myself. It was a love poem again. I read this poem for my MFA compatriots struggling in the muck of all types of criticism and self-doubt. It doesn't stop, it'll keep going. I was struggling in my MFA a lot. I don't know if you guys are the type of poets that are trying to write poems that last beyond your life, which is what I'm always trying to do. I'm always trying to make something that can outlast me, because why else will we make something? But Frank O'Hara is a guy I always turn to. And he had this one line in his poem. I can't find the poem again, because you know Frank O'Hara has a lot of poems. And it's this poem where he says, someday I'll love Frank O'Hara. And I thought, that is the best thing to say in the middle of a poem. Someday you'll love yourself. And so I said, title of poem, someday I'll love Roger Reeves. Here it is. Someday I'll love Roger Reeves. And thank you for your kindness and for like this. Don't forget that poetry makes other things possible. Poems make more than just poems possible, okay? Last piece of propaganda. Someday I'll love Roger Reeves. Until then, let us have our gods and short prayers, our obligations, our thigh bone connected to our knee bone, our dissections and our swans. Our legs gashed upon a barbed wire fence and our heels tucked behind a lover's knees. Let us have a stalk of sugarcane to suck and another to tear our backs with what it knows of disaster and a tadpole's folly. Let us have mistakes and fish willing to come to a bell rung across a body of water. Let us have our drawbridges and our moats, our heavens no higher than a pile of dried leaves. Let us have irrelevance and a scalpel, a dislocated ankle, and 3 more miles to run. A plastic bottle to hold nothing but last names and a chill. If none of this will be remembered, then let us keep speaking with tongues light as screen doors clapping shut on a child's finger. For this is love, to press one frame against another, and when something like a finger is found between this pressing, to press nevertheless, for this is our obligation. Let us forget our obligations, for this is love. Let us forget our love. Our eyelids need for beginnings and ends and blood, our coils of hunger that turn another into dried honey on our hands. And what if this goes on forever? Our hours, our drafts and fragments, our blizzards and our cancers. Then let us hold each other towards heaven and forget that we were once made of flesh, that this is the fall our gods refuse to clean with fire or water. Thank you.